Welcome back to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable. We've got a special treat for you this week. Uli Korch is the, edit please, Uli Korch of the Monetary Trust Initiative is also the chairman of the New Horizon Council of Economic Advisors. And Uli is particularly involved recently with a project called Infrastructure Without Debt. Uli, I'm sure our listeners are wondering, what are you talking about, infrastructure without debt? Infrastructure is expensive. How are you going to pay for it? What are you talking about?
I love that question. Let's start with what debt means with respect to infrastructure. So you're driving down the road, and all of a sudden, you know, you slow down because there's construction. And there's a big sign that says, you know, dear taxpayer, ladies and gentlemen, aren't you glad we're building a new bridge for you? And it costs $100 million. What they never tell you is, in actual fact, whatever amount that you see, it's actually twice that. So if they say $100 million, it's actually $200 million. The average infrastructure cost over the lifetime of the bond issue that ends up being used to pay for that is twice the principal amount. So the moment you talk infrastructure somehow without debt, we haven't got to the how yet, you are saving 50% of all of our infrastructure costs. That's a bit of a mind blower for most people.
Well, that certainly would be, but I guess, you know, I try to put this in context. If I look at my view of the long term, where we are in this debt cycle, we've already got so much debt, the economy is under so much burden, it's hard for me to imagine how that is possible. So maybe we should start with your view on both the long-term and short-term outlook for the U.S. economy.
Okay. Let's talk about the macro as to where our money comes from. Because if you talk infrastructure without debt, the money's got to come from somewhere. So where does it come from? Right now, basically, 100% of our money is created by private banks. It's not created by the Bank of Canada in Canada or the Federal Reserve Bank or the ECB in Europe or, you know, et cetera, which is what most people think. In actual fact, the money is created through what we call deposit creation. So let me walk you, then we'll go through the short term. This is a long answer to the short term and long term question you just asked. If I want to buy a car, I want to borrow $30,000. So you go to the bank. And they say, oh, Mr. Townsend, yeah, you're a good guy, no problem. We'll lend you the $30,000. And they sign a contract. That is an asset to the bank. The bank is not out of balance on the balance sheet. And so what it does is it deposits $30,000 into your account. Where did that $30,000 come from? Nowhere. It's created out of nothing, ex nihilo. We call it deposit creation. And that's where our money comes from. Now, the crazy thing, if you pull that in reverse, let's use nice round numbers. Let's say you were charged a 10% interest rate, terrible interest rate today, I'm well aware of that, but you had a fantastic year. You had never made any payments during the whole year. And at the end of the year, you walk into the bank and you owe the bank $33,000, 30 for the principal, 3 for the interest. What happens to that money? Well, the $3,000 in interest, that is income to the bank, the $30,000 in principal is destroyed. It did not exist at the beginning of the loan, and it does not exist once the loan is paid off. That's one reason why deleveraging economies, which is what we've been at since the Great Recession, are so terrible to get out of. Okay, long term and short term. When you understand that concept, the ramifications are enormous. That means in order to have price stability as our overall production, our GDP, increases, then the amount of money in circulation must also increase. And the only way that can increase is through more debt. So we are constantly increasing the debt load. Now, for the US dollar, that's a bit worse than the Canadian dollar, because we are the top of a list of global reserve currencies. So our debt load ends up being part of the global debt load of all those who use US dollars. But the burden on us is incredible. This is a very slow, long-term process. So we've now had a Federal Reserve Bank for 100 years, 103 years this year, you call it 100 years. And slowly we get to the level where this simply is not possible. It isn't just that the government runs deficits. It's the structure of our whole economy, short-term, long-term. Long-term, it's going to crash. So how do we solve that? One of the ways of solving it is to change the who gets the seigniorage on the creation of that money. What the blazes a seigniorage? Seigniorage is the difference between the value of the money and the cost of that money. Let's take a $1 bill. Let's take some nice round numbers. Let's say it costs 1 cent to print the dollar bill. Then the seigniorage is 99 cents. Okay. Now, of course, today we don't, you know, 97% of our money, whatever, is electronic. It's not paper money at all. So essentially, the seigniorage is 100% of the value of the money. It doesn't cost any money to type some keys on your keyboard, which is how we create money today. All right. Well, who gets that seigniorage today? It is what I call an indirect seigniorage. It temporarily goes to the bank because the bank, for a short period of time during the course of a loan, is allowed to use that seigniorage to charge your interest. The bank didn't have the money to begin with. The bank does not have the money at the end, but in the meantime, it can charge your interest. That's its income. Let's just, and then I'll get back more to the long term. Let's just for a second walk through what most people think banks actually do. People think that banks intermediate funds, all these $63 words. It means they take money from savers and they give it to the investors, to the people who want a loan. Now let's walk through this, back to the $30,000. So let's say you want to buy a Toyota. So you go to the bank, and the bank takes $30,000 from a saver and puts it in your account. That's what people think. All right. So what you do is you go to the Toyota dealer, and you pay them the $30,000. You get your car. The Toyota dealer pays the $30,000 to Toyota. Toyota pays the $30,000 to the employee who saves the $30,000, which you now use as a loan. Whoa, that's a circle. The money never came from anywhere. But that's what everybody thinks. Okay, long term, this will result in a crash. Short term, there are ways of solving that. Let's talk about the American system. In Canada, actually, it's a similar thing until Canada joined the BAS, Bank for International Settlements, in 74, I believe it was. Here in the U.S., we used what are called U.S. notes. I have one here in my office, and I show it on some of my videos. And there are still 240, roughly, million dollars worth of these U.S. notes floating around. And the only difference between them visually, if you actually take a dollar bill, visually between a Federal Reserve note and a U.S. note is that the U.S. notes always have red numbers. So if you ever see one, for heaven's sake, hang on to it because it's worth a lot of money. Because they've become collector items because since 1971, the Federal Reserve has stopped replacing them. That was used by Lincoln, President Lincoln, to pay for the Civil War and build infrastructure in the whole country. And that is infrastructure without debt because it's treasury money. The treasurer creates the money, and today's system would deposit that in the Federal Reserve Bank. It carries no interest whatsoever. And the seigniorage goes to us as taxpayers. And that is infrastructure without debt.
So essentially, you're talking about building out national infrastructure by printing money, but it is the government directly that's printing the money as opposed to the Federal Reserve, which a lot of people don't realize is technically not part of the government. So you're suggesting the creation of new federal notes as opposed to Federal Reserve notes that essentially could be used to purchase these infrastructure improvements.
Absolutely. You're absolutely correct. It can be a bit of a nuclear option. Whatever you do, you do not want to allow the politicians to control this because they're just going to start printing money like crazy. We are living in a temporary period of time where this can be done really easily because other than asset inflation, we do not see much consumer inflation. And this would not be asset inflationary. This would be for Main Street. We live in a time where this would work really well. Milton Friedman was in favor of this. Irving Fisher, and back in the 1930s, Irving Fisher, Milton Friedman in the 60s, basically every American economist signed off on this saying, you've got to do this during the Great Depression. You just have to do this. And the big banks killed it.
So essentially what you're saying is that the deflationary or disinflationary backdrop that we have right now, despite all of its woes for other aspects of the economy, is essentially, James Bond had a license to kill. You're saying the federal government has a license to print money without the usual inflationary adverse consequences. And you're suggesting that they should seize that opportunity, not involving the Federal Reserve, create actual federal treasury money without the debt that is created when the Federal Reserve is used as an intermediary, and use that to immediately fund infrastructure. And I guess what I feel we need to come back to is most people would accept the argument that if you're going to build infrastructure, a new bridge, it's going to serve society for the next 20 or 30 years. And although a lot of our listeners might favor the idea that society ought to save up for these things and pay for them in cash when they're needed, you know, most people believe in this mentality of, oh, if it's going to be used over the next 30 years, we should pay for it over the next 30 years. Why doesn't it make sense to use debt to finance that? Why would we go ahead and, you know, you could build infrastructure by directly monetizing, federal money creation, but you could also do helicopter money. You could just send every citizen a check for a few thousand dollars and not build any infrastructure. And you could use the same argument of insulation from adverse risk of inflation because of the current macro backdrop to justify that. And you know, if it doesn't happen to appeal to me personally, but I think a lot of people would say, gee, if I could get a free bridge, or I could get the bridge, subsidized with debt for the next 30 years and get $2,000 in my pocket next week, I'll take the $2,000. What would you say to that argument?
Basically, I agree with you, but let me tell you where I'm really going with this. I'm Fisherian in my economics, which is that I do not believe that private banks should have the power to create money. It is an unbelievable privilege that no other structure in the world has. The banks are the only ones allowed to do that. And I personally believe that should be taken away from them, and it should be given back to the government. And the amount of money that is then created is equivalent to the increase in production, goods and services. And the infrastructure without debt came because about 2 years ago, when I was going through the whole Fisher system of monetary control versus the system that we currently have, I was challenged by a couple of people, and they said, "You know, that's just too big a leap. You gotta create some small steps, incrementalize this process." And I said, "Well, kind of like being pregnant, you either is or you ain't. You know, nobody's half pregnant, okay? It doesn't work." And the more I started thinking about it, that's where the infrastructure without debt came from. Because I said two things. Number one, everybody wants infrastructure, right? And we're all screaming, saying, you know, especially here in the U.S., saying, man, for heaven's sake, we've got to spend the money. That's number one. And number two, the current disinflationary environment that we are in allows a temporary step. And my point in this is to teach people about U.S. notes and treasury money or sovereign money, or in the U.S., U.S. money, U.S. notes, that this is a viable option that has been used historically, and that, even after the 30s, like I said, in the 30s, I actually have a list, I think, of pretty well every economist that was alive in the United States at that point signed off on it. But, 30 years later, Milton Friedman was still pushing it.
So you're saying this has been done before. Are there wins and losses? Are there good stories and bad stories? What's the history of infrastructure, building out infrastructure through the direct monetization with treasury money as opposed to using debt to finance it?
With respect to infrastructure, the only story that I know of is here in the U.S., which that's not totally true. Guernsey, for 200 years, has used this process, and they run it in parallel with the British pound. Guernsey, the three major, I think there's only three inhabited islands. They're just off the coast of France. And as part of the defeat of Napoleon during the Napoleonic Wars, those islands were deeded across to England in spite of the fact that they're, within a long swim of the French coast. So they've been on the British pound, and England never did a thing with it. I mean, it was total backwater, and it was a disaster. And so basically, in frustration, they said, you know, this isn't working. We're going to create our own currency. And they've now done this for about 200 years. The results, I have several papers on this. The results have been absolutely spectacular, beyond belief, really, really positively.
And are there downsides? Have there been cases where inflation was triggered by this kind of money creation?
No, neither in Guernsey nor here in the U.S. There was a strong inflationary period during the 70s and 80s. It's 1870s here in the United States. Milton Friedman and Anna Schwartz, who wrote the definitive book on that era, spend about 20 pages explaining that the inflation during that period of time, just short of hyperinflation, it's pretty bad, had to do with the terms of trade with England and the rest of the world, which are all gold-based. And this had nothing to do with U.S. notes. So they literally spend 20 pages on this. And for those who don't know Milton Friedman, between Milton Friedman and Irving Fisher, those are the two people that pretty well everybody that's in the economic field believes those are the top economists the U.S. ever produced. So these are not small names. These are household names, certainly people that understand the field. And for them to definitively say this was not because of the U.S., because of use of U.S. notes. One more thing, by the way. Because they do not create debt, but there's no such thing as equity accounting in government accounts. It's still listed technically as debt. I'm going to get to that just for a minute. So I call it no debt debt because it creates no indebtedness. So in the list of U.S. federal debt that comes out at the end of every month, so now you can look at September, look at any month you want to. And on page 13, the list is about 20 pages long. It's all broken down into every kind of debt that the federal government owes. On about page 13, it lists the U.S. notes and says the $240 million, $239 million, whatever it is that are still outstanding. And these are not listed. This is not part of the normal list of delineated U.S. debt. So when Congress, for instance, passes the law, the increase, the allowed increase of indebtedness, U.S. notes are exempted from that. In other words, even the federal government recognizes they don't really, even though they're listed technically as debt, they're what I call no debt debt. And you'll see that right in there.
Now, I want to play devil's advocate here because I do appreciate your argument that we temporarily, and I underscore the word temporarily, enjoy an opportunity by the backdrop created by disinflation, that you could do something like this without it being inflationary.
Right.
Or in fact, the inflationary effect, which it's guaranteed to have, would be desirable because it helps to offset an undesired disinflation that's already occurring. But if I put my cynical hat on, it sounds to me like what you want to do is teach the politicians in Washington who historically have never been responsible about the long-term adverse consequences of their actions, how to monetize spending so that they don't have to tax to pay for it, they don't have to borrow to pay for it. You and I both know that if you teach them this trick, they're going to keep doing it until something breaks. And when smart people like you say, hey, wait a minute, this was my idea, but it's not a good idea to continue this because we're starting to see runaway inflation creep into the system. It's not a good idea to do more of this. They've already learned this trick, and they're going to keep using it. So I fear that we're tipping them off with this podcast in terms of how they might find yet another way to spend recklessly beyond our means.
You remember 15 minutes ago, whenever I said this is a nuclear option. It's either nuclear power or a nuclear bomb. It can be abused. I'm currently working on a monetary control function, and I'm writing a paper on it. But the assumption there is that the banks will not be allowed to create money anymore. That takes the inflationary part out of it. Because what I'm calling a monetary commission, I don't care what you call them, run by the Federal Reserve, which then makes that decision, the price stability portion of it is locked in, and it's totally viewed by the public as nothing to do with the politicians. But initially, yes, it's the politicians that end up making the decision. Part of the control infrastructure, without doubt, in my mind, is that it should never be 100%. So the U.S. federal government makes very few actual infrastructure decisions. It runs the FAA and the interstate highway system. There's not much else. Almost all the infrastructure decisions, I don't know what the percentage is, but it's got to be around 85-90%, are made by municipalities, states, but mostly very local, cities and school boards, etc. So the funding should never be 100%. That then trickles down. Of course, the municipalities do not make those decisions. On the other end, I recognize the federal Congress, that they're voted in by local people, especially the House members versus the senators. It's a bit of a different story because it's, you know, two per state here in the U.S. I agree with you that that danger is there, but let's be negative. I think we're heading for a major crash. And at that point, I would like to radically see the system changed, because I don't see any other way out of this. I do not see any other way out of this. And if we could run this for a couple of years, the infrastructure without debt, people say, "Yo, let's change the whole banking system, because this does work and we haven't created chaos."
Well, let's probe on that a little bit, because I certainly can understand an argument for let's try this for a couple of years because of the backdrop that we have. But you can't be proposing that for the future of all time, we're just going to pay for all of our infrastructure, because you know that's going to expand to other government expenses by monetization. Yeah, that eventually is hyperinflationary if you let it get out of control. So how do you see this? I mean, you understand that risk. You're a smart guy, you're a responsible guy, but you know that elected officials don't share your degree of prudence and responsibility. So how do you control this idea, and how do you take your invention, if I credit you as the inventor of nuclear power, and get it channeled into nuclear energy and not nuclear war?
I think, to be so negative, because I don't believe we've got a lot of time, we're at the listed federal debt is at $20 trillion today. And most estimates are by towards the end of next year, we're going to again be running deficits of about $1 trillion a year. The fiscal gap, let's talk about what debt actually, what the government thinks is debt. Let me walk you through an example. So let's say you want to buy a house. And so what you do is you go on borrow $300,000. And so let's say your monthly payment, interest plus principal, plus here we often, you know, we call an escrow. So what we do is we include the cost of insurance plus the cost of taxes. So insurance, taxes, interest, principal equals, let's say, $4,000 a month. Okay, whatever, just pick a number, it doesn't really matter. And so you go out and borrow $300,000. And the first month you make your $4,000 payment. Next month, you know, the wife wants a new carpet, and so you're a bit short. And interest rates on credit cards are just basically zero anyway. So what you do is you put $1,000 in your credit card, and $3,000 you have. So the $1,000 for the credit card plus three equals four, so you make a $4,000 payment. Next month, you know, the living room isn't looking very good, so you buy some furniture. That's even worse. So you short $2,000. So $2,000 you have, $2,000 from your credit cards, you make a $4,000 payment. Okay, you keep on going. It's not been a good year. At the end of the year, you have put $10,000 on your credit card, but you've made every $4,000 payment. Okay, what do you owe? What would you and I say? Well, you know, the first year in a 30-year mortgage, your interest payments, your principal payments are almost zero. Let's just call it zero, just for simplicity's sake. So you owe the mortgage, which is $300,000, plus you owe the money that you know on your credit card, which is $10,000. So you would say, well, I now owe $310,000. You know, we can subtract $500 for principal. We call it $310,000. Let's say the government does this. What does the government owe? Well, the government would only owe $10,000. They don't owe the $300,000. You go, what? That's really stupid. You see, the government, according to the system that we're using here, and in Canada, it's exactly the same thing, the government only owes what it's put on its credit card. You go, the government doesn't have a credit card. It's got to do all you have to do. We call them treasury bills, bonds, government savings bonds, right? That's the credit card of the government. So it only owes the issuance of its treasuries. What does the government actually owe in contract that it has signed? We're talking a net number. If you take the net expenditure minus the anticipated net tax income, here in the U.S., we owe $205 trillion. $205. You know when that's going to be paid? Never. And that's the collapse that's coming. By the way, I know what $1 trillion is. You want me to explain to you what $1 trillion is? I found this really useful.
Sure, go ahead.
I know it's one with one heck of a lot of zeros, which means nothing to anybody. So here's something that I found really works. Most of us, we can get a handle on $1 million. Okay, you know, it's a nice house, and you know what, $1 million. Okay, I can get a handle on $1 million. Let's say you were to spend $1 million every single day, 7 days a week. In what year would you have had to start to spend just one of these 205 trillion, just 1 trillion, just 1 trillion? I'll tell you, it's 500 years before Christ. You can get your calculator and work it out. I'm right. That's just one of these. We owe 205 of them.
Yeah, it's absolutely amazing. And when you say we, that's the United States. If you look at the global debt, I mean, we've got more than $10 trillion of negative yielding debt around the world, which is insanity. I mean, it's
utter insanity. It's killing the banks. It's killing the savers. It is financial repression.
Now, let's. I'm again trying to play devil's advocate. What if I were to say to you, you know, I'm a real believer in the value of my own money. I've been forced to entrust the government to issue it. What you're saying really is that you want to institute policy, which is to dilute the value of my money in the sense of expanding the money supply, as opposed go ahead.
No, totally agree. Totally disagree. Our money supply is constantly increasing right now, and we do it through debt. Okay, and we stabilize that through interest rates, and through the desire of banks to lend and the desire of borrowers to borrow. Okay, and it constantly fluctuates back and forth. And the role of the Bank of Canada or the Federal Reserve Bank is to try to stabilize that with interest rates. And so the whole system's got a hell in a handbasket. And so we've got this insanity called a negative interest rate because it ain't working. So what I'm saying is we are not going to increase the money supply. I call it a toaster currency. Bit of a joke, you know, tongue in cheek. Every time we build a toaster, let's say the value added worth of that toaster is 50 cents. I'm just picking this, you know, out of my shooting from the hip here. That means we can create 50 cents worth of money. We're currently doing that through debt anyway. All I'm doing is shifting the methodology of how that money is created. Except the seigniorage long term goes to the Canadian or American or German or European or beats me, whatever, taxpayers. Because it will reduce our taxes, but the amount of money that's created is identical. It doesn't change one bit.
So how do you, just talk me through the process of how do you see this being administered and controlled? I mean, if you're talking about basically instituting a new program of direct monetization, creation of new money for what hopefully is good purposes. You know, politicians will find bad purposes. There will be all kinds of effort to, you know, funnel the spending into my district, on and so forth. How do you control this whole process?
They would have nothing to do with it. The amount of money that is created, just as it is now, is strictly dependent on our capacity to produce. So real value. So instead of gold-backed, this is production-backed money. You can't increase it or decrease it. You don't play with it. And it's publicly posted. It has nothing to do with the politicians. They happen to get a portion of it. Currently, they do with taxes anyway. But the amount that is created, just as it is now, is dependent on production capacity, except currently it's all through debt. Our productive capacity is measured by our capacity to handle debt. The problem is, in the long term, we're making a rope to hang ourselves. Versus the Fisher system, we are not hanging ourselves with our rope. As a matter of fact, in the long term, it will decrease debt, both private and governmental. The private, but I mean by private, I mean individual and corporate as far as governmental. But the amount of money that's created doesn't change. It's the methodology that changes.
Okay, and what would the long-term ramifications, both positive and also potential risks, be of this approach?
Well, there are huge risks for two types of people really hate this. One is lawyers, especially bank lawyers, and the second is government regulatory agencies, because we don't need them anymore. The system is self-regulating, other than the control of the money, which you hand to a separate, deliberately separate group of people under very strict rules, as to you publicly see as to how that's done. The downfall is the banks will, still make money. I roll with Kotlikoff, Larry Kotlikoff. I don't know if that means the name means it. Limited purpose banking. Does that mean anything? Well, I'll talk to the listeners. Larry Kotlikoff is formerly on the President's Council of Economic Advisors, and what he is suggesting is that the investment portion of banks would all be mutualized. Let's back up here just for a minute before we go into that. Let's talk about banks. So under the system that I'm suggesting, if banks are not allowed to create money anymore as they do right now, how in the world would they function? Well, what you do is you divide banks into what I call two windows. The World Bank uses the word windows. I didn't make it up. So the World Bank has different windows depending on the function of what they're doing. So same with your local bank around the corner, Bank of Montreal, TD, Wells Fargo, I don't care what bank. You walk in, and the teller is the teller. There aren't physically two different windows, but the bank has two different functions, which I'm just calling windows. One is the depository and payment window. So you deposit $100, and that money remains your own. I don't know if you know, but most people do not understand when you deposit $100, that is not legally your money anymore. You do not own that money. What you own is a receipt from the bank that's an IOU that says, when you want this money, I will give it back to you. But in the interim, it is the bank's money, not yours. You read your banking contract, and it's quite obvious. So that's why we have bank runs, because if everybody tries to get the money at the same time, the bank doesn't have it. We run a fractional reserve banking system. What's that fraction? It's about 10%, plus or minus, in the world that we live in. And so all that $100 that you deposit, the bank only has the capacity to pay you instantly back $10 in the aggregate of all the depositors that it has. In this new system, the depository and payment window, 100% of the money remains yours. So if the bank goes bankrupt, all your money's still there. It has nothing to do with the bank. The bank is simply the operational character, but there's no merging of the funds like there is right now. All right? So if you use a credit card and you have enough money in your depository window, it's paid. Checks are paid. You wouldn't notice any change. However, there's no interest on that. Well, there currently isn't any anyway. So you're going to pay some fees on that. However, the income and the investment side is the investment window of the bank. So you put $100 in. You say, hey, I want to make some money on my money. So you want to move $50 across into the investment side of the bank. And that side is mutualized. So it's a whole series of mutual funds. So there's a mutual fund for car loans, a mutual fund for home mortgages, a mutual fund for, blah, blah. Every bank would run 20, 30, 40, 50, depending on the size of the bank, different kinds of mutual funds, depending on risk, return, liquidity, et cetera, that you can read the description and you can put your money in there. But they're all equity based. So during the crash that we had in 2007, 2008, mutual funds did not go bankrupt. As a matter of fact, I don't know one of them. I'm not saying none did. I just don't know of any. But banks collapsed left, right, and center, because mutual funds are equity-based, whereas banks are not. They leverage like crazy, because they merge your money with their own money and try to make some kind of a return on it. So with this new system, that would not be the case.
I think there's an important point that happens to be one of my favorite topics, which is so many people are misinformed and think that federal deposit insurance protects against all these risks. And I want to make sure that it's clear to people that federal deposit insurance very, very effectively protects against the risk of one bank failing because of who knows what, you know, incompetent management or, you know, fraud or misdeed or what have you. But government insurance does not and cannot protect against a systemic run on the fractional reserve banking system. It can only protect against a run on an individual bank or a couple of banks.
Correct.
And it's nowhere close to big enough to actually protect against a systemic risk, which I think probably is a risk that we should think about happening in our lifetimes.
Yeah.
Get it out, please. Before we wrap up, Willie, we're pretty much out of time. Is there any key point that you want to make, or should I follow up on
what you said? Because what you said is so true. I don't know what the percentage is in Canada, but I'll bet you it's very similar. In the U.S., by law, the FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, has to hold 1.15% of the aggregate deposits. That's all it has to be able to cover. Just over 1%. After the Great Recession, it didn't even have that. It had less than 1%. It's been surcharging banks all of these years, and it just hit the magic 1.15%. Can you believe it after all these years? 1%.
The corollary, it may be obvious, but I want to make sure that our listeners understand it, is that means that this insurance is 100% bulletproof and effective at assuring that we are protected against a run against up to 1% of the banking system. And
Absolutely.
If the run is bigger than 1% of the banking system, we're screwed.
You got it. And that's a highly technical economic term, screwed.
Thanks so much. You know, I'm sure we could go on for an hour about this, Zuli, but unfortunately, we are out of time. Is there any final last point that you want to make before we wrap this up?
I just want to say that the Federal Reserve, Bank of Canada, et cetera, I mean, because Mark Carney now is the governor of the Bank of England. So this whole international system, they're running on models, and their models are the most important thing. I think we need to change and look at human well-being because we are seriously hurting people. The effects of the decisions that we make have ramifications into the lives of millions, hundreds of millions of people. We need to forget about the models, or not forget, but run our decisions based on true results rather than what we think the model is.
I couldn't agree more. Unfortunately, we have run out of time. My guest has been Uli Korch of the Monetary Trust Institute. And Uli, of course, is also the chairman of the New Horizon Council of Economic Advisors. Uli, as we close, could you just let our listeners know, for those who would like to follow your work, give us websites and, you know, where they can follow what you're doing?
So I'm involved in a number of different things. They all deal with this issue of what we're talking about. Go to ulikorch.com. So ulikorch, ulikorch.com. And everything that I'm involved in is there. It's always a bit out of date, obviously, but ulikorch.com.
Well, Uli, thanks again so much for joining me. Listeners, be sure to tune in again next week for another episode of Financial Repression Authorities Roundtable. I'm Eric Townsend for FRA.